Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We now will convene the House Interim Task Force on DHS Review. We're a little short-handed here at the dais, but we did receive a call from Linda Flores, who has been involved in three traffic jams trying to get here and will be here with us shortly. But she's going through the gauntlet. As a preliminary matter, we want to mention that we will be having an extended lunch break from 11 o'clock till 1. There's some other meetings that need to be attended, and that's required, kind of that unique calendaring for the day. We're going to begin today with an update on the Department of Human Services budget, finance, and cash flow process. This is going to be a repeat of some of the information that was provided to the e-board. Mm-hmm. I was unable to be there, as many of the members of our committee have not been there as well, so it's very worthwhile for this to be broadcast to interested people throughout the state as well as to our task force. And so, without further ado, why don't we just begin with our first item of business, and we welcome Jim Scherzinger and Clyde Psyche, excuse me. And we turn the time to you.
Great. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Clyde Psyche. I'm the Deputy Director for Operations for the Department of Human Services. And for the first part of the presentation this morning, Mr. Scherzinger, who is our Deputy Director for Finance, is going to walk you through some of the cash flow and financial issues that we've been working on since he's joined us about 4 or 5 months ago. And then I will do the second part of the presentation and kind of give an update on improvements in the fiscal area that we've made to kind of deal with some of the issues that came up earlier this year. And so if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Scherzinger.
Yeah, I'm Jim Scherzinger, Deputy for Finance, Department of Human Services. A much more detailed presentation of the contents of what I'm going to talk about today is available in a memo that is the living, working document of the Working Capital Committee that was created out of the Operations Review Team that you may know that the department created, that the director created with the help of DAS and your own legislative fiscal office and the controller's division and the treasury. So this is a very brief presentation of what there is a lot of detail available about, and if you're interested in that, I'd be glad to provide that to you. Why don't we very quickly go to the, there we go. First of all, why does DHS have a cash flow problem? And there are really three major reasons. Number one, processing issues. Our federal funds are on a reimbursement basis, so we have to incur the expenditures before we ask for reimbursement for those expenditures. And then secondly, our payment systems there are lags in the way that our payment systems work, and those result in cash flow problems. And I'll have a very brief chart on this later. Secondly, revenue accruals. We have a number of other fund revenues where we accrue the revenues after the budget period is over. And so the revenues are actually received after the budget period is over, and so the expenditures are made before the revenues are received, and that creates a cash flow problem. And thirdly, we make advance payments to providers at the beginning of the biennium, and then we recover them later as the biennium goes through. So those are the three major sources of our cash flow problem.
Are you going to go into detail into these components?
I have a little chart on both the payment systems and on the revenue accrual, so that will get you a little bit more detail. And then I feel totally comfortable if you have questions, just pop in and ask them.
The question I have is about the advance payments, if you could explain how that works.
Well, essentially, we have a number of providers who have cash flow issues themselves. and we make an advance payment at the beginning of a biennium, and then we recover that over time when they send their bills in and we repay them. We recover those advance payments, and that creates some cash flow. Obvious cash flow issues for us. In other words, we're working to help them solve their cash flow problems, and that creates one for us.
Chair Richardson,
substantial amount? Is that a high percentage of the anticipated revenues to be paid over biennium, or how?
I would say of the issues that you have seen in terms of our cash flow issues, the major sources have been the processing issues and the revenue accruals, and these advances, because they're largely out of the general fund, they don't show up in the cash flow issue that the e-board has seen from us. They're still there. I don't have the dollar amount right in front of me. They're a significant dollar amount, but the two biggest issues are the processing issues and the revenue accruals.
And Chair Richardson, these payments are primarily to counties for the mental health, alcohol and drug, and public health services.
Okay, I understand it wouldn't be the major factor here. It's just a new twist that I'm not aware of, and so now it's like, you know, I've got to find out what that's about.
When we went through this process, what we were trying to do is catalog everything, try to find every reason we had a cash flow problem, analyze it, come up with numbers. And I think as we've worked through it, what were the recommendations that the committee is coming to are really more around the processing issues and the revenue accruals. But to be complete, we needed to add all of that in there. And as I said, if you want the full detail, we can provide that.
Just a moment for our committee, our task force, and we'd like to welcome Representative Jensen to join us today.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I'd like to give a setting for what we're talking about. In the last quarter of the sessions of each biennial budget, we have a difficult time because DHS has essentially budgeted on a cash basis, but has revenue, part of the revenue doesn't come up, it's on an accrual basis. And so we have millions, tens of millions of dollars that are not going to come in until after the beginning of the next biennium, and yet they're budgeted as if they are there in the current biennium. And so last time, and I didn't go back and look at the numbers, but it seems to me it was $77 million. There was some convoluted problems because there was some money borrowed from the treasurer, and then you also came to the legislature and asked for $70-some million, and then there was a loan made that was going to come and be repaid out of the revenue that came in after the beginning of the next biennium, only to find out later on that a substantial amount of it was a problem and didn't come back, and so it wasn't repaid. And part of it we knew, and part of it was a surprise. Part of that problem was there was revenue expectations from a program that no longer existed from the federal government, and other things, which kind of opened up this whole issue to a close scrutiny to determine the tracking of revenue, the determination of expenses, and how this is going to happen in the future. Because, and I brought this up during our last budgeting session with the co-chairs, if we don't deal with this, then at the end of every biennium, you have the same problem.
Right.
And so something has to be done so that you don't constantly have to say, well, again, we won't have enough money to make it through, but we'll get it back later. And so rather than be in a constant situation every biennium where you're borrowing money, there may be a better way to do it. And so the purpose of this presentation and the work you're doing is to identify all the factors involved in this, what the alternatives are, and then hopefully the co-chairs and the budgeting process can look at possibly alternative ways to deal with this than just make massive loans at the end of each biennium.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Any other things you'd like to add to that?
No,
I think that was a good summary.
It was a good summary of sort of how we got to this point. And I think as I get toward the end, I might want to say something about sort of what really happened from a financial standpoint. But let's run through this and then...
Thank you.
It'll be easier to understand.
Representative Dalto.
And as you consider talking about that later, Mr. Scherzinger, maybe you could also give us a little description of what exactly happened between 2004 interim and 2005 in terms of caseload numbers as 2005-2007 budget was being built by the governor and the Department of Human Services.
I think you actually have more on that, but I'm not sure that answers the question that you have, but we'll see when we get there.
Okay.
I want to say a little bit now about as you look at the cash flow issues that we have, there are some things about DHS as an agency that make it more difficult to talk about it. And I've done a very brief summary. It doesn't get anywhere close to presenting the full complexity of it, but I think it gives you an idea of why things are a little bit more difficult. First of all, the systems that DHS have are very complex. We have over 20 different payment systems for how our payments are made. One just example that I think, and there's a legions of examples, but one that I think really shows how complex that some of our processes are, is that when we do our cost allocation runs, those are the runs that assign costs to federal funds, other funds, and to general fund. That process itself is so complex that when we do the final one each month, we have to turn the cash controls on the system off. The cash controls, the complexity of them with the cost allocation runs, they just don't. And so we have to turn the one off to do the other one. And that's just an example of how complex our system is and makes it difficult to really understand where we are from a cash standpoint. The second thing that makes it more difficult is that the whole business situation that DHS is in is that our general fund requirement, the ultimate expenditures that fall to the general fund, are to some extent a residual. If our federal funds or especially our other fund revenues are off, we don't collect the amount of other fund revenues that we had expected, that cost falls to the general fund. And so it's not simply a matter of we have some federal funds or we have some other funds, and if they don't show up, we just don't spend the money. No, in our case, by the way our system is designed, the way our whole budget is set up, is that those costs then fall to the general fund. And if there's a time lag in knowing whether our other fund revenues are coming in, then our ultimate general fund cost, there's also a time lag on that. And so the time lags that exist in other funds all kind of flow through into having an effect on the general fund. And so those lags cause both budget and cash flow issues in terms of knowing if we have a long revenue accrual, then to know where we actually are in our budget requires knowing what's going to happen to that accrual. And then the third thing is that over time, the agency, in order to solve some of these problems, have created a lot of workarounds in the system. And those workarounds themselves make it more complicated because you have to kind of undo all the workarounds to figure out what's really going on. So all of these things made it more complicated than it might otherwise seem to be.
Mr. Chair?
President Dalto?
Could we have a discussion on the workaround with that?
We'll define that and explain how that works.
Well, for example, one of the things we do to make sure that there's enough money in our suspense account, and I'll explain what that means in a minute, is that we process an expenditure through the system that isn't what you might call a true expenditure. There isn't an actual thing that we're buying. And the effect of that expenditure is to push cash into the suspense account so that we don't go negative in our suspense account. No money actually goes out to anybody. We don't actually pay anybody anything. But the effect of that is simply to be sure that we have enough money in our checking account. And then but it still shows up as an expenditure on our system when we look at our expenditures. So if we're trying to do and say, well, where are we with our actual expenditures, we have to back that out all the time to really figure out what we've actually expended. We do that because that's the way the processing system works. That's just one simple example of a workaround. And we have a number of other workarounds in our system that try to deal with the fact that the cash controls don't really work properly. And I could talk a little bit about that when I get there, but that's an example of a workaround, is where you put something into the system to make the system work, but it doesn't really give you accurate information about what your actual expenditures are. And you may have heard at the time, just a little bit more history, is we've had the Secretary of State come in and they had audit findings. And a lot of those audit findings were around their having issues with some of the workarounds that this they built into the system.
Mr. Chair.
Hold on.
Thank you. So if this were a public corporation with you know, fiduciary responsibilities to audit their books with a private, you know, accounting firm that does the auditing and reporting to all those various entities that they have to do in the private sector, would it permit this workaround business?
Well, I think certainly they're not illegal or the major ones are not illegal or as long as you keep an audit track of them. I think there were some issues about some of the workarounds that were in the audit findings of the Secretary of State, and there was quite a debate as to whether or not those things were illegal or not. What I told the e-board was that it didn't really matter to me that I didn't think they were good practice and they shouldn't be done, and so that's why we need to do a review like this. If we have systems that, in order to operate our agency, if we have something in our system that's causing us to have to do this, we need to find a way to not do it because it's not good practice and it doesn't give us good information. And whether or not it's illegal, that's something that the attorneys can figure out. My goal was to not do it. And I think we've made some progress. We've definitely made progress in those areas that the Secretary of State found questionable. We haven't done those things.
We wouldn't want to call it a modified form of kiting, but the reality is that you have no reserves.
Right.
And so you have to make sure that the payments don't bounce.
Right.
And so you're having to take practical moves or actions to assure that there's money there to while you're waiting for the reimbursement.
Right. Mr. Chair, the alternative would have been not to make payments to clients or providers.
When we truly have the money.
I'm glad you're looking at it because there needs to be a better way.
It's a little bit different than you might think about with a private business or even a school district. I know in the school district we had basically one checking account. We rolled everything into it. The way the Treasury works here, you don't do that as an agency. You have all these other, you have multiple accounts and you have to do things to move money from one account to the other. You can't just call them and say, move money from here to there. You have to process something through the system. And so these are the kinds of workarounds that are built is because of the system, not because of anything that is, you know, sort of theoretically something you shouldn't be doing. Okay.
Representative Hanson, good morning.
Good morning. Just two things that possibly you could touch on through the presentation that I have concerns about. One is the information technology capacity of the agency capable of, or is that, are we technically able to work this complicated of a budget with the technology that we have? And secondly, if part of our problem is in terms of the timing, I know there's a commission that's looking at annual sessions and changing some legislative practices. Are there any changes in terms of when or how we set the DHS budget that might impact and smooth some of this out in terms of our forecasting and when the federal budget passes in September and hopefully we adjourn in July, it seems to me we've got a built-in problem. But well, if you could touch on those things as you're making your presentation.
Well, let me sort of deal with them directly. On the first question, we're using the state accounting system, we're using RSTARS, and I think it's a good question as to whether or not that system is sufficient to take us into the future. So what the operations review team decided in their recommendation to the director and what we're following through the process is that we're going to There are clearly many things we can do to fix our processing now, and we're going to do those things and try to push the current system as far as we can. And if we find in doing that that the current system isn't adequate to meet the needs, then we'll develop a business case for a change. But we think it's important to push the current system as far as we can and to make the process improvements that we can make now. And then at some future time when we develop a business case, if we need that, we'll bring that. I think a case could be made that it's inadequate, but I think we need to push it, because not only do you make a better case, but you really learn better what you need when you try to push the current system you have to its capacity. On the second question, which now I'm spacing on, was about the timing.
What's the timing is about?
I don't think the budget timing is the issue. It's really when do you get your revenues versus when do your expenditures occur. And I think there will be definite recommendations out of the Working Capital Committee that will try to that will deal with trying to correct that. I mean, right now, and I'll show that when we get to the revenue accrual section. When you really look at our financial system, it turns out that there are really two significant problems. It's not just one cash flow problem. One has to do with our suspense account. And if you just think about it, and I have a little chart on that I'll talk about, I'll show this, is that our checks tend to hit our checking account, in effect, our suspense accounts, before our revenues do. And, like I say, just because of the way our processing works, and I'll show that in a minute. Secondly, is that we have cash controls on the system, and what cash controls do is they keep you from spending money unless this control shows that you have cash. It's sort of a calculation that's made, and unless it shows that you have cash, it won't let you process an expenditure. The truth of the matter is that the cash flow of the agency is negative throughout the whole biennium. It's always that way. What we do now, and it's sort of one of these workarounds in a sense, is that we borrow from the general fund through most of the biennium by the way that this cash control works. But all of our general fund authority is used up by the end of the biennium, and so that's why we're ending up coming to the legislature at the end of the biennium and asking for a loan. The truth of the matter is we're negative cash flow all the time. It's just that it only shows up at the end of the biennium because we're running out of general fund authority to cover the problem. And then, more complicating factor is that these two different problems combine in unique ways, and sometimes the workaround to solve one makes the other one worse, and so it makes it more complicated. So, very quickly, because I think this is a diagram, a very simple diagram, an overly simple diagram of the way our payment systems work. And very quickly, let's say that we're making a payment, and we have over 20 different payment systems where we're writing checks to providers or to clients, or sometimes they're cash transfers, especially to providers. And let's say we make a payment. That payment is made either through a check or a transfer, and if you want to look at, so up from the payment, the person receives the check, they take it down to the bank processes it, it's presented at the Treasury, the check is cashed, the transfer is made out of our suspense account, just like you would write a check out of your own account. What happens on our side is once that check is written or the transfer is authorized, it has to run through these controls in the accounting system, the RSTARS controls. And one of them is over authority. Do we have enough authority in our general fund or other funds? There are limitations that you passed on us. So you put a federal funds limitation and other funds limitation and general fund appropriation. Is it within our authority? And secondly, do we have the cash by this calculation of cash? And if it passes that control, it's processed into RSTARS. If it's a check, it runs through what's called the 382 process. If it's not, it sort of goes around that process. And it causes cash to transfer out of the receipted account, which depends on whether it's general funds or other fund or what particular other fund it is, or federal funds. And it transfers the cash into the suspense account, and the two have to come together pretty roughly at the same time in order for your suspense account to not go negative. And so if there's any kind of problem that handles that you in processing checks through the system, through the controls, then that cash isn't going to show up in the suspense account. Check will be cashed, transfers made, and we go negative. The Treasury charges us interest. We don't like to pay interest. It's just like if you overdraw your checking account. Bank doesn't like it, and you have to pay if you do it. So that's one problem, is that suspense account can go negative. And the second problem is that sometimes the cash controls, especially at the end of the biennium, because they're tied to our general fund appropriation, won't let expenditures process because we, quote, run out of cash. And so those are the two problems that we have that are on the processing side. And the committee is making a whole set of recommendations to try to fix some of these things. Getting rid of the 382 process is something we're already doing to try to make these processing lags solve some of the cash flow problems that we have. Second chart, this is on revenue accruals. We have, and I think our estimate right now is about $80 million in revenue accruals. That is where we say that revenue that, and here's a quick chart here. Let's say, for example, that our revenue accrual policy is that we're going to accrue revenues for up to 3 months after the end of the biennium. So provider tax is a good example. The provider taxes, say they're paid quarterly, and you're paying in after the end of June for the prior quarter. So here you're a provider. You get, you, in effect, you say, for this quarter, I owe X amount of money for the last quarter of the biennium, but I don't pay that until the next quarter. Well, what we do in our accounting system is that we accrue that revenue that we received after July up through September into the prior period of time. So in a quick chart here, the expenditures, say, have occurred between July of 05 and July of 07. That's the red line. But that the revenue we're actually receiving in terms of cash for that July to September period, we're carrying that back to the 03-05 biennium. And we're using that to cover expenditures in 03-05. And then in July of 07 to September of 07, revenue is accrued back to 05-07. So the net effect of that is the expenditures are occurring before the revenue is actually received from a cash standpoint.
This is probably a very simpleton kind of question because I don't understand accounting, but how hard would it be to change the definition of the budgeting process to include accrual revenues expected within 90 days following the end of the biennium so that you line them up instead of having a firm cash basis budgeting for expenditures and then an accrual basis for revenue?
On an accrual basis, from an accounting perspective, what you want to do, and this is good accounting, is to attribute expenditures to the period of time in which you incurred them, not necessarily when you paid them, but when you incurred them, and revenues when they were earned. So this isn't necessarily bad accounting. It just has a cash flow result. And so you have a number of potential solutions to try to solve this problem. And one of them would be to not do revenue accruals just for cash flow reasons. Another is to carry balances in other funds to solve the cash flow problem. Because I think what really happened over time is that this didn't show up as much before because there was enough slack in the budget to cover it.
Okay, both of the things that you've mentioned would require additional funds in a current budget to make up for the shortfall, which has been discussed, but the legislature is a little hesitant to give up $70 or $80 million that they can use someplace else merely to balance the accounting budget. And so is it an option to include in the budgeting process revenues that are reasonably anticipated within 90 days following? In other words, an accrual, allowing for the accrual portion to be actually used in the current budget and not have to deal with this problem of a cash-based budget with an accrual-based revenue stream.
But you still have a cash question. If you wanted to, but you're still going to have the budget problem, if I understand what you're saying. You're saying take the expenditures and accrue them to the prior period. Well, then you're going to have to pay them. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't matter. You're going to have to find a way to...
Except that your system that you already explained to us said that it looks at the authority versus the cash, and that your authority is based on revenues that are anticipated within a period of time, but that time ends at the end of your biennium. And so that gives you your shortfall. And so you'd have your authority extended if you could use the accrual basis for the additional 90 days afterward. You'd be short of the cash, but...
You're short of cash. You're still short of cash.
You still have a...
You have the authority.
A treasurer.
But we have the authority.
Yeah, we have enough authority in the... the question of whether or not you're balanced your budget is an accrual question. Do you have enough of revenue attributed to that period? Do you have enough, is that more or at least equal to the expenditures that you have attributed to that period? That's purely an accrual question. Any private business has that kind of question when they publish their books and the stockholders look at it. But it doesn't mean they don't have a cash flow problem. And they may have to go out and borrow money to cover the cash flow. They may have to, it just depends upon what the circumstance of that particular business is. And this is the same thing.
Okay,
is that
you.
More authority doesn't really help in the sense that unless there's actual dollars behind it. So there's really no way to solve this revenue accrual problem.
There ain't that much float.
Without some sort of fiscal effect. And I think what happened in the past was that because there were balances sitting out in some of these other funds and they had carryover balances, or there was just enough sort of slack in the budget, if you want to call it that, that only when we came in 03, 05, and 01, 03, and they started pulling all those balances out of the system to try to balance the budget, they just sucked up all the slack out of the system, and all of a sudden you have a cash flow problem.
And was your float?
I think, yeah, it was sort of, it was being covered on the float. And so, anyway.
Okay, that explains that.
These are the kinds of workarounds that we're doing in our current system. I already talked about that loan to ourselves when we process an expenditure to try to fund the suspense account. Another thing that we do is that it's called parking expenditures in the general fund. The way the current controls work is that if we incur expenditures, say, that ultimately are going to be covered by the provider tax, and we don't have that cash from the provider tax right now, what we have to do is we have to attribute those expenditures to the general fund. So we count them as a general fund expenditure. And then when the revenue is received, we transfer the expenditure to the other fund provider tax. And that's a workaround in the system. So in the meantime, that revenue, that expenditure sitting there in the general fund, it looks like a regular general fund expenditure. But because of the way the cash controls work, we can't spend that other fund money until we have it. So that's another type of workaround, is to park your expenditures in the general fund until the other fund revenue comes in. We can also do it through allotment adjustments. We get a general fund appropriation, the allotments aren't necessarily equal every quarter. And that's how we cover the advances, for example. Loaning among funds. That's the one issue that we did this last biennium that got us into the audit finding. Those are the kinds of workarounds that are in the current system. And the difficulty with the workarounds isn't necessarily that they're wrong. In some cases, maybe they are, but they're not necessarily wrong. It's just that they confuse the books. If you have to keep backing the workarounds out to figure out where you are in the middle of a biennium, then the books are less transparent. And we want to know where we are at all times. We want to get workarounds out of the system to create a more transparent process. So the committee, in looking at it, these are the goals that we're working at. No workarounds, transparency, simplification, and separation of budget and cash flow issues. I mean, fundamentally, cash flow issues are ones that there ought to be a system to handle. And they ought to be as clear, how we handle them ought to be as clear as possible. And we ought to be able to come to you as the legislature and deal with our budget in the way anybody else would. That is,
Mr. Chairman,
this is how much money we spent, and it's within our budget.
Well, we have one question about, on your prior sheet, it shows advanced federal draws. How available are advanced federal draws?
Well, you can do them. You'll pay a price. And as we've been talking to other states and looking at their processes, we believe there are ways to improve our process that would make our federal revenues come in and be available to us on a more timely basis than they are now. But unfortunately, I think this is where you do get into a systems issue. We're currently doing our federal draws through a very complicated spreadsheet process that we've got to figure out a better way to do it. And when we do that, I think we can find some improvements on the processing side on our federal draws. To do advanced federal draws, there's an interest cost to that. And so that's not something we want to do unless we absolutely have to.
That's a good
question.
Mr. Chair.
That's a good...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a good point. So how much in arrears are our federal... our federal money, is there any way to expedite or change the system to get the federal money quicker?
What we've done is...
Let me ask a correlating question. How do we compare with other states as far as the delay time? Are some states getting this turnaround very quickly and we're not?
What we've actually done to date on the federal side of it is that we've... If you might want to think about it, if we have a payment that's due to somebody... We've actually started the process of processing that expenditure earlier than the payment goes out. And we've done that in order to create a time lag for the federal draw to occur and to actually get us the money as close as possible to when the ultimate check is drawn to try to minimize that cost. There are still some issues left in our payment systems that still create some amount of lag there. But the bigger problem is that if anything hangs up in the system as it goes through, we could easily end up with a day or two lag. So I think what we've done in our system is we've eliminated a lot of the suspense account problem this biennium by advancing the processing. But we have some significant system issues that that cause us to... I mean, that's in itself a kind of workaround. And so we need some systems work to try to make that whole system work a lot more clearly so we know where we are. So I think what we've done is put in a pretty good workaround to solve most of that problem. But it needs to, for lots of other systems reasons, we need to find a better way. I think as this committee has looked at the numbers, and this is actually work that we did after the e-board meeting now, since the e-board meeting, is that we think we've got the suspense account by eliminating the 382 process. We're going to be pretty close to okay with maybe just a relatively small advance. But any time anything goes wrong with the system and something doesn't process, then we're going to have a problem. But what we've had to do to get that done is do some things that could be done better with better systems. And that's, I think, where we're going to go next.
Could you take just a moment and explain the 382 process? It keeps coming up.
The 382 process is one in which what actually happens is that when the payment is processed through RSTARS, it puts a record on the system. And when a check is presented to the Treasury sends a data file of those checks that have been presented to DAS. They match it against expenditures that we've been processed in RSTARS, and they don't transfer the money into the suspense account until the transactions match. It's a matching process. And the effect of that is to create a whole day's delay in almost an automatic one-day delay in the crediting of revenues to expenditures. Rather than as soon as the expenditures are processed through the system to transfer to cash and actually create a little bit of float, they don't transfer the cash until the checks are matched against the expenditures. And we're working, we've worked with DAS, and I believe in September is now the target date, mm-hmm. to shift over to eliminating that process entirely. So then the cash will transfer at the time that the expenditures are processed, and if we process them early enough, they'll get there before the checks, and we'll actually have a little bit of float. So we think we're pretty close to solving the suspense account problem, unless there's a hang-up in the system. So then it's a question of eliminating the hang-ups in the system.
So that deals with suspense, but doesn't deal with...
It doesn't deal with the whole question of the revenue accruals and the cash controls on the system. But, you know, you work at it. So the kinds of solutions that we're looking at, I put in two categories. One is, can you reduce the need, you know, reduce the cash flow problem to begin with, and then secondly, providing working capital to the extent you still have a need. And these are the kinds of things you can do to reduce the need, ending the 382 process we already talked about, eliminating the lag in reconciling deposits. There's a time lag over in DAS in reconciling, if once you get a deposit, of attributing it to the right account and reconciling that. And they actually are in the process of doing that right now. That's an ongoing effort. Processing expenditures earlier, I already talked about how we started to do some of that. Improving other fund revenue estimates, that's a huge priority, not only for budget purposes, but also for just getting a better handle on what our ultimate need is. Consolidating treasury accounts, and then improving our other fund revenue collections. To the extent that we're lagging in collecting revenue that is due to us, that's going to create a cash flow problem. So those are the kinds of things you do to reduce your need.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, how much are we talking about as far as not collecting?
I don't really have a good handle on it. I just didn't want to leave. I don't think it's a huge number, but I just didn't want to leave that. I didn't want to leave that off as an option. That we need to, any agency, to the extent that we're collecting revenues, we have to be vigilant about collecting them. And sometimes we're talking about collecting them from other governments. It's not about necessarily from private.
Let me give an example. The state gets a rebate from certain purchases of pharmacy drugs. Well, there were two pharmaceutical companies that hadn't been making their rebates because we'd been sending the request for payment to the wrong address.
Yeah.
And this went on for a substantial amount of time, and nobody was tracking to see whether or not the payments were coming in. And so this is part of a process problem to track your revenue, to know where the sources are, and to make sure that the revenue is coming in. Is that correct?
Right. And, you know, you've got this issue with the reconciliations with the counties on payments that we've made to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a number of places, and in the grand scheme of things, they may not be large dollar amounts, but it's important if you're going to be efficient as an agency to pursue these things.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Yeah.
Is that data, the information about this, is that in the state report that we get, the debts uncollected? Now, there's like $400 million in the judicial system.
Yes, there is a report. That isn't necessarily, I mean, that's maybe a piece of what I'm talking about here, but it isn't, a lot of things wouldn't even show up in that report, because we're talking about even a month lag in collections is something that's going to add to your cash flow, and before it even hits that report.
Okay, we have less than 15 minutes left, so we need to decide how we're going to spend that time, and certainly we'd like to know, you know, the focus right in on what is happening as far as solving these problems, and do you have recommendations? And
right. And so I'm actually here pretty close to the end. So reducing revenue accruals is a big potential way to you might count that as reducing a need. Here are some other options that are more long-term in nature, like ending our own check writing, shift to having warrants done like some states do, which would have, you know, we'd process all the expenditures and then DAS would write the checks through a warrant system. But that would take a lot longer to do that. And then simplifying our accounting structure is another thing that we really might ultimately do. Provide working capital. There are a variety of ways you could provide working capital. One is through a general fund appropriation, either on a one-time or recurring basis. Another way to do the same thing is to carry other fund balances. So let's say our provider taxes, if the amount that we actually accrue, even if we continue to accrue them, we just wouldn't spend them until the next biennium. And that's a way of building a working capital fund. Second is through some sort of loan process. Thirdly, and this was a sort of a thinking outside the box solution, I think is not kind of the way that the committee certainly is leaning on going, but it's the way some states actually work, is to convert everything to a general fund appropriation. So all these other revenues would come in to the general fund, and all we would do is we'd spend general fund money, and we'd just worry about staying within our budget. Somebody else would worry about whether those revenues are coming in and the cash flow problems of the state. The state of Oregon has a cash flow problem most times anyway, just as a whole state, and not just DHS. So,
well, that would shift the problem. The problem would still be there. The last
it'd still be there, but the treasurer would handle it. And, and you know, maybe they're more capable of handling it than we are. Yeah, there's a simplicity to that. But there's lots of other things, other issues around doing that, issues with the kicker, issues with, you know, the size of the general fund and stuff like that that make that less attractive as an option. Or some combination of the above, you know, maybe shifting some revenues to the general fund and the like. I think, to be quite honest, the group is leaning more toward a combination of the first two. Maybe some looking at our revenue accruals, doing something with revenue accruals to deal with either an appropriation or building balances over time or just not doing them, all of which have fundamentally the same effect, and then trying to handle the rest of the cash flow issues with a loan that creates a more of an incentive for us to solve our processing problems.
Next question. The Treasury, when they loan money to DHS, are they borrowing that money, or is that from reserves that we already have in Oregon?
Generally speaking, they're borrowing the money from other funds. So they're taking money that some other agency has and that are other funds, and which otherwise would be out invested and earning interest. They're loaning it to us instead. That's generally what they're doing. Usually it's an other fund loan.
Yeah, but us is them.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and so one option you have is to say the Treasury will not charge interest on this one issue.
Right, and that is actually a one of the options that we put on the list to be complete. That was not particularly popular with the treasurer.
Do I see that on this list somewhere?
Yeah, it's
in next slide.
It's on the second 11. Reduction of need. Stop charging suspense account interest.
Oh, that's what that was.
Yeah,
I saw that. I didn't understand that. Okay,
and so that. Now, that doesn't necessarily, well, yeah, and that is an option that we, it, like I say, it's not been particularly a popular one because it really goes against the way that the whole Treasury is constructed. It's different from what I was used to at the school district. In the school district, you know, we're in the bank, and we have, you know, the school district is one account. It's one, you know, we have different accounts, but ultimately they treat us as one customer. And but the state is like one entity, and we're just part of the state. So how much of the cash problem is our problem is a complicated question, you know, because the state is really the entity, and right. How much of it is our problem is a debatable point. And so but we chose, I think, not to want to recommend necessarily changing the whole way the Treasury does its business to solve our problem. And so that's why we're looking at the other choices.
Well, certainly it is an option because it wouldn't cost hard dollars in the next budget.
Right.
And so I just think that it shouldn't be skipped over.
Right. But to answer your question, when they loan us money, typically it's another fund loan, and they're they're in effect, instead of investing somebody else's money, some other agency's money, they're loaning it to us and charging us the interest.
Right.
That's
exactly
what they're doing.
Ripson, wasn't it?
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So the last thing.
I have a couple of questions here.
The last. Okay.
Representative.
But it's some other agency money that they're loaning.
Right.
It's not the other agency going to have their nose a little bit out of joint if they're loaning their money out and not paying them for it.
Yeah.
When they can loan it. When
I
they
mean,
can
it could be some of our money.
It
could be some of our money that's dedicated that we can't spend on general fund or on normal program. I mean, it's any wherever they're getting it. It could be PERS. Who knows where they're getting it?
Well, I'm thinking of PERS because of trust fiduciary responsibility.
No, but they could do loans. It's just like an investment.
You can, as long as somebody's paying the interest.
Yeah, as long as they're paying the interest. All right.
But the point that we're making is, if we're paying interest to ourselves, possibly we need to look at that in a different way.
Right.
Representative Dalto, do you have anything?
Well, I guess my only question, Mr. Chair, was, what happens with the interest that's paid on this money? I mean, what does the Treasury do with it?
Well, it's then credited to whatever accounts where whoever they borrowed the money from. I mean, they would have to answer that specifically as to how they structure it. But generally speaking, it would be paid to whatever entity loaned us the money.
Point is that sometimes we get so committed to a process that we're currently using that we quit looking at maybe that process could be adjusted. So anyway, it's on the table.
I guess from my standpoint, I got enough worrying about DHS's problems without fixing the Treasury, too.
Certainly, but you are going to be giving recommendations, and you know more about this than any of the rest of us, and so the legislature certainly wants to see all the options and not merely have one division of government decide that that's not a good option because another division of government may not like it.
Right.
So anyway, Representative Hansen.
Well, when I was involved with local government, we had cash flow problems based on the time property taxes come in. They come in November. And
right.
And the use of tax anticipation notes seemed to be the real common vehicle that everybody used. And through some magic, we always made money on them.
Right.
I'm thinking that the treasurer should be able to come up with some type of a device that could solve this problem, even if there's interest rates on a 60-day note, or the interest income off of a 60-day or a 90-day investment is pretty minimal. You would think we should be able to solve this problem. Even if it involves some interest, it would be very, very minor.
Yeah. It's a different situation because if you're a school district or a city or a county, you're one entity. And what you're doing is, when you're issuing tax anticipation notes, is that you're borrowing money at a tax-exempt interest rate, and you can do that under federal law up to a certain point to handle your cash flow, which, as you said, tends to peak in November. So you have a negative position. You borrow to cover that negative position, but tend to keep the loan for the whole year. And then you invest the excess funds at a taxable earning rate. And so you make arbitrage profits on the difference. And if interest rates are high enough, when the interest rates are really low, it doesn't do you much good. But when they're high enough, you actually can make money on the deal. And the school district used to do that all the time. The state, since it's the whole entity, it can't really isolate Department of Human Services as a agency within that and kind of do the same thing. When it looks at its cash flow issues from the state as a whole, it has to look at the state as a whole. So I think it's just a different set of problems.
Is that because it is a state agency that it can't be done, or it hasn't been looked at?
Well, it's just that this DHS is not separable. Like, we're part of the general fund. We can't really separate us as a financial entity from the rest of the state.
So that's exactly what we're doing when you go to the treasurer to ask for money and you have to borrow it and pay interest.
But it has to do with how our treasury works, not about all the federal laws about when you can earn arbitrage profits. I guess that's what I was saying.
I guess my point would be if the treasurer did an examination of all various budgets, that there might be some other similar circumstances as this to issue one tax anticipation note that might cover a DHS problem and fish and wildlife. I'm assuming since the fishing licenses come in at one particular problem or one particular time, there might be a whole range of state budgets that could benefit from that type of advice.
And they do issue tax anticipation notes when the state is in a negative cash flow position, but you'd have to get them in here to talk about how they do that and when. And
is that something that has also been looked at as an option?
That has to do with a much bigger problem issues than DHS.
I know, but we're as a legislature, a DHS review committee, we're going to be asked what recommendations the legislature might take up next session to help alleviate this problem. One is, let's just find $70 or $80 million and put it into your budget so that this doesn't happen again. But knowing the political realities, that kind of money may not be available.
Right.
And so we're going to find ourselves in the same situation that we're basically in ongoing unless there's some alternative that is not just earmarked money that goes there. And so we're just looking at different ways.
Well, and I think, that the treasurer would welcome a discussion of the cash flow problems it has, because the state has a cash flow issue on a fairly regular basis as an entity. So it's probably something that's worth a discussion. Okay, next steps. The working capital.
Fritz Jensen has.
Oh, okay.
I'm just. We're kind of looking at this as a unique sort of thing with DHS here, but I'm curious. What really is so different between what we're encountering here and what a company, a corporation, would be encountering? Because most companies, revenue lags the expenses. This is not, as far as I can tell, it's not a unique problem to DHS. It's not a unique problem to government. It is a problem that will always be there so long as the revenue comes in after the expenses have been incurred.
And I agree with that. I think what's different here is that basic reality is the same. We've created a system of when our revenues come and our expenditures are incurred that has a negative cash flow situation, that when you marry that to the systems that we have, it creates a level of complexity and encourages a series of workarounds to solve the problem that is inefficient. And that what we need to do is figure out a better way to manage the cash flow problems that we have. And it's a combination of simpler systems, separation of budget from cash flow issues, and taking specific strategies to manage the cash flow problem we have. And it may be, and that's sort of the options that you would be looking at, and it may require some amount of appropriation to help do that. That's the choice that you have. So it isn't any different in theory from anything a private business would face. It's just that the particular systems and the particular business problem that we have make it so complicated. And we need to get rid of the complexities.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair. And there's a follow-up and a question on this for Jim. What we need for you to help us with, I think if I'm understanding this correctly, is what are some of the things that we as the legislature, since we're not authorities in this and we don't have in spite of the time and effort that go in on part of some individuals in the legislature, we don't have that breadth of detailed knowledge. What are some of the little clues? Where do we look to find where the problems
Well, the Working Capital Committee, which is the next steps. I think that's what you're asking. What's the next steps? Which is my last slide. The Working Capital Committee is not only DHS folks. It's people from the Treasury, from DAS, the Controller's Division, from the Budget, and from LFO, from the Fiscal Office. And they're working through this at a more detailed level than we've talked about today. And they will come up with some recommendations. So I think once, and actually pretty close, we had a good meeting the other day. We're in the midst of calibrating the dollar amounts. So we sort of worked up the theoretical underpinnings of this. Now we're calibrating the dollar amounts of the shortfall. And the goal was to have recommendations to the director by July 15th. And I think we sort of have a tentative recommendation, set of recommendations now when I have another meeting. And then DHS is supposed to, as part of the rebalance in November, come up with a recommended solution for 0507, and then we're creating a budget package for the governor's budget for 0709 based on this set of recommendations. So we're pretty close to a set of recommendations. We have a little bit more calibration work to do, a little bit more process work to do, but I think we'll be able to come up with a pretty good set of recommendations, and even more importantly, the kind of theoretical underpinnings and explanation of how the system works and where we need to go. I think one of the elements is definitely going to be that is that some of the systems changes that we need are going to have to take place over time. So we're going to have to sort of work toward this solution. Because the underlying goal isn't just to solve the cash flow problem. It's to simplify the system enough to give better budget data. Because the biggest problem here is really that our cash flow problems, the workarounds that we're using to solve these cash flow problems, are creating complexities in the budget that shouldn't be there.
Okay, when is the next time the Working Capital Committee will meet?
You know, we haven't set another meeting. It's vacations have been crazy.
Well, that's wonderful. That means that in 4 days you're supposed to have a report of recommendations. Our committee's meeting today.
Yeah.
You're not going to meet in the next 4 days, and you haven't given us a copy of those recommendations.
Well, this was our goal, and we actually have a draft that I'm distributing to the members that came out of our last meeting as sort of a tentative set. So I think we'll certainly meet the deadline enough to meet the timeline. This deadline was set for the creation of the budget package.
Okay,
and we're
going to
meet that time.
You know what, we're over time, but let's spend just a few more minutes and have you give us a summary of what those recommendations are.
Well, essentially, they go back to... where are my solutions here? Some of these process things that are already in place, the 382 process, the lag in reconciling deposits, processing expenditures earlier, to continue those things, the numbers that we've looked at say that by doing those things, at least... we have to actually implement to see what they actually will do. You can estimate that they're going to solve the problem, but you can't really prove it until you actually do it and they solve the problem. But we think that we can solve the suspense account problem with a combination of those things, maybe with a relatively minor amount of working capital. So that's the recommendation is to do that and then to implement a real process of identifying every time there's a system hang-up why that hang-up occurred and adopting ways of trying to solve that. And then sort of in our long-term plans to implement things to simplify the system. Some of these things that we can't change immediately that we're constantly monitoring that. So that...
to kind of focus this, have you an estimate of what the shortfall is going to be for the next biennium?
For the next biennium.
Now, supposing that we were actually in December of this year and you're saying that we're going to have a problem with revenue shortfall in 2009, the last quarter, how much do you think...
We're saying that the size of the problem from the revenue accrual point of view is about $78 million.
Okay, so it hasn't changed too much from
last. And then if we can find ways of dealing with the process issues that sort of eliminate or make that relatively small, then you're looking at something a little bit more than that, whatever that small amount is.
Okay, part of your recommendation was that there be a capital contribution toward the $78 million.
Then the rest of it is we don't, they don't, we have, we, yeah, I think that they're looking at a combination of a some sort of capital contribution.
Okay,
plus
just pretend that you've got a recommendation. What kind of,
let's say, for example, one thing you would do is to say, here's the amount of the problem that's caused by revenue accruals. What that really means is that you are spending money that you don't have.
Right.
And so,
Jeremy, we're dancing. I don't want to dance.
All I'm
saying, you gave us an overview of the problem.
I'm saying,
and now we're asking what the specifics
are. Find a way
to
pay for the current expenditures out of appropriations.
Okay, so $78 million is what you're going to be recommending we add to the budget?
And the rest of it, well, I'm not saying that's their recommendation because they haven't all agreed to that. But
okay.
I'm just saying, as an example, that's one way, one type of recommendation you could have. Could be to phase it in over time. It just depends on how, you know, that's almost more the political question than the.
Okay, and I know you don't really want to answer it, but so what you're really
just
saying is that
example.
ultimately, there are things we can do in the system to make it work better, so that we can track things better, but ultimately we're still going to be $78 million short at the end of the next biennium, and so we can either pay the $78 million as part of the budget and face it now, or pay a part of it, maybe only $30 million, and then we have a problem for $48 million, and then the next biennium pay a portion and pay it down over time. Is that basically?
You definitely have at least the $78 million problem no matter what you do. That's right.
Okay.
And so how you pay for it, you can figure out as easily as I can. I don't know specifically what the group would recommend, but to me, that doesn't matter as much because ultimately you're going to decide that.
Okay, well, it's been very helpful to see that it's being confronted.
Yeah.
You know, the problem's being confronted, that the revenue streams are being looked at and to determine what's real and what has just been assumed. The accounting procedures need to be reevaluated and maybe changed. If you need additional help with the IT, I mean, we're looking at that now, and we have, you know, I don't even know the relationship between CNIC and all of these other things, but we want to make sure that DHS has the accounting tools needed to track revenue and expenditures. We want to make sure that that the alternatives are all fully identified, even those that might be a little bit difficult for some areas of government to accept. But one of them, I mean, ultimately we have $78 million that we're going to be short, and we're going to have to come up with that some direction. Is that basically
I think that's correct. And I want to say, because maybe this is agreeing with that, is that I think that from my interest is really that the systems get fixed. Because I know that ultimately you're going to make the decision about how to manage and how to pay for the expenditures. So in that process, we need to have better systems and a more transparent budget and better tracking of our ongoing expenditures. So what my real interest is to try to get the workarounds out of the system, make the system as simple as we can. And I don't want to lose sight of that, and I don't want to get ahead of your decision about how to ultimately manage the cost.
We're so glad you're there and that these ideas are being considered and that you're looking at this.
Right.
Before we close out, Representative Hansen.
One option would be if we looked at the total need of the department's working capital, is there some type of a vehicle that the treasurer could come up with, a bond measure, COP, some type of a thing that we could borrow the money over like a 10-year period, and then we'd know that there was a fixed period over the next five bienniums that this was what it was going to cost us, and that would have to be built into the budget.
Yeah, I'm sure that the Treasury, between DHS and the Treasury, we could figure out the least cost way of creating any sort of working capital fund. I'm not concerned about that. They know how to do that, and we know how to try to pay as little as we can. And so I think that all of those things there we're fully capable of doing. I just think that the bigger political decision, sort of how to manage this, I think that can be made, as long as we lay the groundwork enough so that the facts are clear. Yeah.
That's great.
Okay.
Final questions, anybody?
Okay.
There was so much more that we could have gone to. Our time is up. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, for facing this, giving us accurate information, which the legislature is certainly going to have in making these hard decisions next time.
Are you like quite off the hook? Is that what you're doing?
That's what we're doing. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like to move on to the next item on the agenda, the Deficit Reduction Act?
Yes.
Mr. Chair? Okay. I'll ask Vic Todd, who's our administrator for our Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs, to join me at the table for this part of the presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair.
Go ahead.
I'm the gesture. For the record, my name is Vic Todd. I'm the administrator for the Office of Self-Sufficiencies and staff. And what I wanted to talk with you this morning about is the Deficit Reduction Act and its implications around impacts on the TANF program. And I think you're getting a handout soon that I'll work from, and my intent is to talk a little bit about the background of the current program, talk about the Deficit Reduction Act, some of its implications, particularly talk a little bit about the participation challenges that stem from this, and also then some of the possibilities and next steps that we'll be looking at. So what you're should be getting is actually a series of three displays. The first one, which is the one I'll work from, is mostly just a narrative display, and I'll try to go through that as quickly as you'd like to. But mostly there's narrative there for you to look at later if you so choose. Then also I've provided is a couple of displays that the federal government produced and kind of gives you a perspective that they have in terms of the changes with the Deficit Reduction Act.
Okay, we have 45 minutes, and so maybe we could spend a brief time just setting the stage that the federal government has passed a Deficit Reduction Act, which is going to have an impact mm-hmm. on the way we do business with our clients, and then focus in on where you see the greatest concerns for Oregon, what do you think the consequences can be, and what's going to be done to help deal with it?
Certainly. And that is really my intent, is to move through it so you have adequate time for questions at any point.
Thank you.
So assuming you all have the narrative display, I'll just begin. And I've numbered these not so much that there's a numerical sequencing to this, but just so that if we have questions, we know which one we're referencing. In terms of background, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program that Oregon has was really designed back in the early 90s when the caseload was really at a level that was at 40,000 plus. And so its design was really around that size of caseload. By 2000, the caseload had been reduced to about 15,000. And I think that the piece that's important about the Oregon model at that point is that it really used a balanced approach, in that most states were using either a work search-based model exclusively or moved to an educational model. And what Oregon really did was Oregon had actually tried both of those approaches at various times under the Family Support Act, which preceded PORA. And what Oregon really came to find was that there was a need to mix those two approaches because of the variability in terms of client characteristics. So there was a real focus on client responsibility as part of sharing, achieving an outcome for the client. And so that entailed, a lot of life skills activities, a lot of barrier examination and dealing with those barriers. And during that window, Oregon had a pretty rapid impact on its caseload. And so it was talked about as a national model and so forth during that window. Beginning with the 97-99 biennium, because of the dramatic decreases in caseloads, that really freed up considerable amounts of federal funds that could be used for other types of activities that were allowable under PRORA, but were really not historically related to cash assistance and employment and training. So Oregon really began to use that money in other ways in terms of supporting child welfare and some other areas as means to fund those program needs. So as a result of that and subsequent revenue shortfalls, the program really from 97-99 to current, the employment and training portion of this program had a significant reduction in terms of the amount of funding that was there. It went from about $137 million in the 97-99 biennium with a caseload of a little over 18,000 to its current level, about $97 million, with a caseload currently in about the 19,000 range. So a significant change in terms of the available funding, and that really caused a shift in a lot of ways in terms of the services that were available. And so it really moved more towards the work search focus than what had been kind of the prior practice. Other issues that impacted this program were the reductions that occurred over the course of the last several years with respect to local services as a result of the recession. One of the important pieces in this whole shift in terms of the size of the caseload and so forth is that the characteristics of these clients have dramatically shifted in the last 10 years in that with this smaller sustained population, you have a greater number of clients who have multiple barriers. So while you still have client group that comes in and is fairly job ready, and they move in and out of the system fairly rapidly, there's a core group that does have significant amounts of barriers, and that's an important issue that we'll talk a little bit more about later as we're talking about the Deficit Reduction Act. So at this stage, because we are so focused on work attached activities, there's some risk that we're really not fully focusing on the family stability issues and not recognizing really what those outcomes are that can occur as a result of that in terms of family disintegration. And the comment on item number 12 that I'm really getting to there is the attachment really that this the TANF program has with child welfare in terms of TANF program families. If they disintegrate, they tend to move, those kids end up in foster care. And the reason that's significant is, well, there are multiple reasons. One of the reasons is there's this significant fiscal issue associated with that, in that kids moving into foster care cost on an order of probably 5 to 6 times more than children that are being sustained within a TANF family. So there's a significant issue there that we want to be sure as we're looking at where does this program go in the future, that we're looking at it from kind of a holistic standpoint in terms of how do we get to the best outcome for the family. The last few comments there on page 7 in the beginning page 2 and 3 is really talking around as we look at moving forward with these regulations and how we're going to adopt our program, that there is a lot of work that needs to occur. And we're looking at working with the governor's office, legislative members, and other groups and individuals around this redesign.
You want to take just a moment and explain how that's going to happen? I mean, this was passed, the legislation was passed, I think, in February, which, you know, so we knew that problems were coming. There wasn't specifics until, what, June 15th or something like mm-hmm. that. But you're saying we will be getting together and we will be starting to look at that. When will that happen and how's it going to happen?
Chair Richardson, I am going to address that quickly. Yes. The interim final rules became available on June 28th, and so while the department was aware of what was coming, they really didn't have a good feel for what it was actually going to mean in terms of what amount of latitude was going to be incorporated, what activities were going to be allowable, and so forth. So we have in the last couple of weeks really began in earnest to begin to engage in that process in a rapid way. So the issuance of interim final rules means is that the rules take effect and have the effect of law, but states are allowed 60 days to comment back. And so there may or may not be some changes to those interim final rules. I think there are several critical issues here, and I've laid them out. First, the language is taking a much more restrictive definition with respect to activities that are countable with respect to the participation requirements. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Key to that is that there isn't an allowance for activities that would be used related to barrier removal. So A&D treatment, mental health, while it's allowable, the window of time is extremely short in terms of it being a countable activity. So that presents some challenges. Probably one of the most significant issues is with respect to the caseload reduction credit. And what that is while you have participation rate requirements, if a state experiences caseload reduction over the base year, they are allowed a one-for-one reduction, so a 1% reduction for every 1% of reduction in your caseload with respect to meeting your participation requirements. The significance of that is that changing the base year from 1995 to 2005, as we talked briefly a little bit earlier, the significant caseload reduction that we had from 95 forward helped the state, enabled the state to operate its program in a fashion that without that reduction credit would not have been possible. So we could invest more in the extended services and so forth. With the change of the base year to 2005, the benefit of that base year is gone, essentially. There's very minimal adjustment that'll occur out of that. So that creates, it will create an issue for a lot of states in terms of choices that they'll need to make.
An estimate of what financial reduction that's actually going to mean for you?
The financial piece I'm going to talk about in just a second, Chair Richardson, and it has to do with penalties and impacts that way. And so it's a little bit different than just a reduction piece. Some of the significant issues around the administrative reporting and verification is that the federal regulations have incorporated into most all of the activities a requirement for daily supervision of clients in most all work-attached activities. So that will present some interesting challenges with respect to resourcing that element. On page four, at the top, I think this is probably a piece that is not well understood with respect to the penalties in this program. the penalties in this program really are a two-part penalty. This applies to all the different types of penalties. In that the first piece of the penalty is that the federal grant is reduced. The second part of the penalty is that the state must make up the lost federal share. So the overall intent is for this program's funding level to remain constant with respect to the federal government's perspective. What that means is that if a state is in violation and the federal government imposes a penalty, it is not just that we have lost federal funds from the block grant. The state must then in the next year turn around and put state funds back into that program in order to avoid future penalties. The item number 7 talks about the work verification plan. This is part of the increased scrutiny by the federal government in terms of how states are actually delivering these programs. And I think that the penalty that they have associated with this particular plan is very instructive in terms of their view, in that if states fail to submit a acceptable verification plan, they are subject to a 5% penalty on their federal grant. This is independent of any other penalties. So it's not an up to, did you make an effort? It is immediately a 5%. So
this is significant for Oregon. Isn't Oregon at about a 14 to 16% verification, and some states are over 50%?
Chair Richardson, the Oregon is, in terms of participation, is at about 18%. This verification piece is brand new.
Okay.
In terms of, and so it's a new requirement and carries a substantial penalty for, you know, noncompliance. The penalties that are under number 8, the penalties that are more likely to affect Oregon without restructuring of the program include penalties related to participation. And that is a penalty that the federal government would look at the effort the state is making and determine is it going to be a 1% penalty up to 5%. And then the state goes into a corrective action plan and can actually receive subsequent penalties for failure to participate. Again, number 9 just talks about that the new provisions don't recognize some of the issues related to client characteristics in the current caseloads. One piece I guess is good news also, is that vocational training is allowed for up to 12 months. So that's a good piece, but it also has some other fiscal implications in terms of adding it. In addition to these work and accountability changes, the Deficit Reduction Act provides for marriage and fatherhood initiatives up to $150 million nationally. Those are yet to be defined, but also they require state funding, and the state funding can count as MOE. One other piece that was adjusted was the amount of federal funding for child care, and that would mean an additional $2.3 million per year for Oregon. The last item under this piece is really just a comment about maintenance of effort, in that they have, in these regulations, also expanded some of the acceptable areas where states can identify maintenance of effort around qualified pro-family expenditures. Okay. The next section is really talking about the participation challenges, and it really gets to that there is a limited set of countable activities and that they don't address the time frames necessary to work through some of the client barriers that exist. There are some exemptions that exist for certain groups. If a family has a child less than 12 months of age, the parent may be exempt for up to 12 months for the life of the case. So that what that means is that if the adult uses up that 12 months for one child, then that exemption wouldn't be there for subsequent children. So it is a 12-month limit for the adult. Adults who are disqualified as a result of non-cooperation can be excluded from the participation rate calculation for 3 months out of 12 months. And if, you know, those other 9 months, then they are included as a zero in terms of participation, and so it has an impact on your participation rates. And then adults caring for disabled family members can also be exempted. On page 6, we'll talk a little bit about just this list that I've mentioned a couple times. Again, all of these, except for the employment, require daily supervision. And just if you look at the fifth item, the job search and job readiness, this is where they have incorporated into the 6 weeks in 1 year the treatment for A&D or mental health or rehabilitation issues. So it's a very limited time frame with respect to any treatment. So on page 7, just some brief comments with respect to some of the possibilities. I think a key one is that the strategic changes and investments that the state is going to make should serve a balanced purpose for enabling low-income Oregonians to gain financial stability and ensure the safety of these of at-risk families. I think that's something we want to keep in the forefront as we're working through this. We want to ensure that we achieve the participation outcomes, the family stability issue and economic stability of these families is more of a long-term issue that we want to be sure to factor into this planning. Obviously, many of the current policies and processes will need to be rethought, changed, or replaced. It's likely that we'll need changes in statutes, new program components, and likely make new state investments in order to make this effort work. We should expect that the outcomes from these investments will have secondary impacts in terms of child welfare and corrections and so forth. At this stage, the department is reviewing the regulations that were released on the 28th. We've started doing a preliminary internal assessment of the existing program strengths, weaknesses, and looking for what areas need to be added to strengthen this program, and doing that in conjunction with an external consultant. We want to form an oversight committee to provide input on this proposed design concepts, and what we're proposing for this membership would be to have two House members, two Senate members, LFO and BAM analysts, representatives from the Family Services Review Commission, Governor's Office, the CAF Assistant Director, and program staff engaged in this, so that we're taking as broad a look at this as we can in terms of what components we like to incorporate here. So with that, I'll stop and
thank you.
Is that quick enough?
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me about the efficacy of limiting job search and job readiness assistance to 6 weeks to a client base that, as you said, oftentimes now faces multiple barriers?
Chair Richardson, Representative Witt, that really is a federal determination, and mm-hmm. and I think clearly I don't think it has. It's well thought through. I think that the challenge is that we have to find a way to engage clients in activities, you know, so that we can meet the participation rates. But we also have to recognize that 6 weeks is not a significant enough time to truly deal with a lot of these issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And would the same be true for vocational educational training, not to exceed 12 months?
I think that, Representative Witt and Chair Richardson, that is probably not as severe an issue in terms of its limitation. I think the one piece I failed to mention around what they term under vocational rehabilitation is that they have also limited education, the education piece, to be non 4-year degree pieces. So it can only be limited to more of the vocational education piece. So, and then we have a component within the existing program that allows for a certain number of clients to participate in degree completion. So we would have to relook at that and determine what impact does that have in terms of us being able to meet this overall outcome.
Okay, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Todd, I have just a few questions quickly. On number 11, you talk about difficulties clients have in meeting the participation requirements. And could you give me an example of some of the participation requirements?
The participation requirements overall is for what they call all families. 50% of the families need to be participating 30 hours a week. For two-parent families, there's a little bit different.
So on page 5, those list of participation right. challenges that you've listed.
Oh, I was on another page. Right. Yes.
Follow-up. Thank you. On number 12, you're telling us about the characteristics of TANF families and threatening of the stability of families and increases potential for movement. And that indicates kind of a speculation. Do you have any statistics that support the actual instabilities and family breakups and things that you experience?
Chair Richardson and Representative Flores, about one-third of the foster care children come from the TANF program. And that number has increased in the last few years, and so it is an issue that I think that as we've moved away from working through the more extensive barrier removal piece, that it puts those families more at risk.
Thank you. And then the barrier removal, examples of the barriers that you're encompassing.
Chair Richardson, Representative Flores, generally that's there are life skills activities, teaching clients, for many of us, some things that would be just normal we wouldn't think about doing, knowing that you need to be at work at a certain time every day, knowing that you need to get out of bed at a certain time. I mean, there's a whole range of activities that...
You've got that soft skills.
Yes, exactly.
Last follow-up, I promise. On page 3, when you're talking about the components of the Deficit Reduction Act, most activities call for a daily monitoring of all activities must be supervised. Supervised by the state?
Chair Richardson, Representative Flores, either the state or the contractor or in some cases the employer. And if it's unsubsidized employment, their pay stubs and things like that can be used. So that's when you're in the employment piece, the daily supervision is not needed in terms of a requirement. But they have other provisions that say this is how you validate that in fact they were there for 40 hours, et cetera.
OK.
Okay, can we go to Representative Jensen, Representative Alto, and Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, best and worst case scenario, what is going to be the cost to the state of Oregon of the Deficit Reduction Act? If you had, and I realize that you probably haven't had a lot of time to, you know, get all the way through that, although you've known it's been coming for some time, since the, long before the June 28th date. Do you have any ideas as to the best case and worst case scenarios?
Chair Richardson, Representative Jensen, with respect to this program, I believe that the challenge here is that the program itself has such a strong concentration in terms of its focus on penalties with respect of a state not performing, the impact to the state is how do you deliver us a program that is effective, meet the participation requirements, and, you know, direct your investments so that you don't come under penalty. It's likely that the state will move from the maintenance of effort level that it currently is at, which is 75% of what it spent in 95, to 80%. And that's going to be true of most states, because most states will, especially in this first year or so, fail to meet the participation requirements. And so then you get into the issue of, you know, well, how strong an effort did the state make with respect to delivering a program, and start negotiating with the federal government in terms of, is there going to be a penalty imposed? So I know I haven't directly answered your question.
No.
And that's
we're not even apparently yet on the same page, I don't think, Mr. Chair, with that. Have we yet... If I can try to follow, looked at other things that might be done then to minimize the impact of the Deficit Reduction Act, and where are we at in the agency in relationship to any of the activities that might be put in place to minimize?
Chair Richardson, Representative Jensen, we have looked at and are looking at what are structural options that we could put in place to enable us to, you know, meet these participation requirements. That's going to take a lot of discussion around what program elements do we want to incorporate into this program. And it's very early in terms of this process to really know what all of those elements would be. But we are looking at and having discussion about, there are many states that are looking at adding to kind of the post-TANF side of this equation in terms of keeping people who have left due to employment on the program through a stipend, if you will, so that they count towards participation. And so that's how states are looking at trying to deal with the limited nature of countable activities and successfully meet the requirements. And that's going to require additional state funding to accomplish.
You know what? He's not answering your question.
No.
I mean, maybe, well, as far as the dollar amounts, what effects do it, and you may not know at this point.
Well, Chair Richardson, I think that's the answer, is that we don't really know what the impact's going to be. We can say what we think the impacts of penalties might be if we don't do certain things, but that's not really where we're trying to head. We're trying to head towards a program that we can avoid penalties and that we can be successful with this client group.
One area is the work participation. If we're at 18% and the rule has been 50%, And, you know, we're not even close.
And that was the reason that initially for the phrasing of the question, best case scenario and worst case scenario, that, you know, best case scenario, you meet it, the impact is zero, I suppose. Worst case scenario is we don't do anything, and this is the worst thing that can happen to us, you know, financially. But I'll pass to that.
So far, we're only focusing on TANF. We haven't even listened to Mr. Psyche yet on eligibility, where we have the governor saying 70,000 people, according to DHS, may lose their eligibility because of inability to come forward and prove citizenship.
Yeah.
Director Goldberg said it was 10,000. No one's addressed the dual eligibles, which wouldn't include those numbers at all. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of numbers being thrown out there.
Yeah.
We have just a few minutes left, and so we have a number of other people. Can
And if I could just make one final comment, Chair Richardson.
Sure.
And that is, it seems to me that this is a program that time is of the essence on, that, you know, we've got to try to do something and do it very quickly. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, sensitive to the time here, I'll just put it on the record and take the answer offline later. I'm pleased by item number 12 on page 4 about child care program, additional federal funds, and I'd like to learn a little bit more about what our requirement is for matching Medicaid money, and we can have that discussion later.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Okay, just kind of from my understanding, it seems to me, and I may be wrong on these numbers, but on a family of a single mom with two kids, she would be ineligible for TANF if she has an income of over $500 a month. What's the income level?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, I believe it's actually $616 for the countable income. The payment standard is 503, I believe.
Okay. So if we're requiring somebody to work 30 hours a week at minimum wage, doesn't that automatically put them over income for the program?
Chair
How do we meld that in?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, that's correct. A person working, I believe, 20 hours becomes ineligible for the current program. And so in talking about that, the potential structure of adding a post-TANF stipend, you would create a different methodology for that group of people, so that you would still be able to count their hours of work towards your participation. Mm-hmm. But it would be a different structure.
So the other one would seem to me that people capable of working 30 hours a week, you know, that have basic job skills and stuff, aren't going to be coming into the program. That we're going to have a very difficult time in terms of, why would you sign up for TANF? Why would you come through the door in the first place if you're capable of going through employment services and stuff and getting a 30-hour a week job?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, there are a significant number of people who come to us that, you know, are termed job ready, but they have some issue which prevents them in a short term from becoming employed. And so we provide those services to help kind of get them over that hump. And they are more employable. A lot of the clients, though, do not have any job skills at all or job experience. And so you're working with that front side to get those people who are job capable into job and providing the supports that they need to get there. And so what you would do is then, to in order to help them stabilize and stay in that, would be to provide this post-TANF piece to help them with some of their just ongoing issues.
Have we done any type of analysis of caseload that would indicate
whether it's remotely possible to, with our existing caseload, of getting 50% of the people in work ready and able to participate in this program.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, I think that that's exactly the reason why we are looking at these other alternatives, is that it's extremely difficult with that ongoing caseload in terms of the numbers of barriers and so forth that they have, to expect that we'd be able to get that group to meet these requirements.
Okay, unaided. We're out of time, but this last discussion really does point out the fact that this is TANF, which is Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. The reason we went from 40,000 in 1995 to 15,000 plus was because it was no longer viewed as a long-term solution to people's problems who can't work. This program was designed to help families temporarily as they get back into the workforce. And so when you say on page 2 that with the DRA, this is an opportunity to re-examine the values, goals, and desired operational outcomes of TANF program within larger context of family stability and child safety, it really is, because Oregon has, I don't think we have a deadline. Some states, after 3 years, 4 years, you're cut off regardless of anything, and I don't know if we have that. So maybe we have tried to modify it to make it more like it used to be within the constraints of the federal government.
Chair Richardson, and I'll be brief. Under Oregon's original TANF program, we worked actually under a waiver that we established prior to Perora. And that enabled us to actually have a 24-month time limit, but that time limit didn't take effect as long as the person was cooperating. With that waiver being gone, we are subject to the 5-year limit.
Okay.
And so there are some exclusions from that a state can take, but all states now come under that.
All right. Thank you very much. If we could
now
turn the microphone over to Mr. Seiken.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, for the record again, Clyde Seiken, Deputy Director for Operations, Department of Human Services. Just wanted to take a few minutes to talk to you about a particular component of the Deficit Reduction Act, which is the citizenship verification piece for Medicaid clients or people receiving Medicaid services. We received the final interim rules from Health and Human Services on July 6th, which was, I believe, Thursday of last week. We are right now looking at an implementation date of beginning implementation on August 1st. The reason we're beginning implementation on August 1st is we are in the process, now that we've gotten the final interim rules, in finalizing policy and procedures, communicating with clients, also providing information and training to staff. And we're also working with our vital records department in our public health division, so that we can, at least for people who were born in the state of Oregon, do electronic matching against the Oregon database, so we can help people who were born in Oregon prove their citizenship. We're also working with several other states to see if we can enter into some cooperative agreements with them so that we can exchange information, especially Washington, California, and Idaho, the contiguous states. Our goal as we move to implement this provision is really to fully comply with the federal law, but on the other hand, we also want, to the greatest extent possible, avoid causing harm to clients' health and safety. And so we want to take a thoughtful kind of strategic approach to this. We estimate now that there are about 10,000 people who are going to have difficulty proving citizenship for a variety of different reasons. We did receive some good news from the federal government, however. In the draft rules that we received last week, there's a provision that exempts seniors and people with disabilities who receive, who are on Medicare or SSI from the requirement, because they go through a verification process
in qualifying for those programs. So if we have someone coming for other services who are SSI or Medicare eligible, they'll be deemed to have met the verification requirement.
What percentage of the 10,000 do you think are dual eligible?
We're calculating that now. Patty, do we have a number? Yeah, we're calculating that, and we can get that to you as soon as we have it, and to members of the committee.
The governor indicated that DHS had announced 70,000, which is a very shocking figure, of citizens may lose their benefits. Where did that number come from?
That was our initial estimate, and it was based on our first pass before we determined that we were going to be able to utilize electronic records to help verify citizenship. And there are several other factors. Patty, maybe you can...
For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Department of Human Services. Because these rules are coming out in bits and pieces, our first estimates, and then we get in some new direction, and now we've finally gotten the actual rules late last week. And that's when the dual eligibles and the SSI, I think so many states talked to the feds that it just wasn't going to work. I mean, people don't... They're 90 years old. We don't even have birth records that go back that far. So I think that they finally exempted them just because it was going to be impossible. I believe the 70,000 was first based on if we do a run electronically against our vital records, we can pick up, I think they estimated around 50%, a little over, of all the folks that are on Medicaid. Then we have another group that are going to have records readily available. Then they figured, and they did this calculation sort of scientifically, then they figured about 70,000 people initially would not have their records available. The way the rules are set up, we can, if they're on our rolls right now, we can continue their Medicaid. But if they're not and they walk in our door, they have to wait to get coverage until they get the paperwork. So there's no retroactive coverage. So they figured about 70 would sort of fall into that. Now, that will be lower if you take the dual eligibles and SSI out. So we haven't got the new figures yet. The rules just came out Friday, so...
Okay, I have an appointment with the speaker, so I'm going to hand the gavel to Representative Dalto, and we can continue this. Mr. Psyche is unable to come back after the break, and so we need to continue this until you're satisfied with the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And then we had figured approximately 9,000 people would be unable to get any documentation of their birth paper. People that came from the South, sometimes it was noted in family Bibles, they don't have birth records. But then with the dual eligibles and SSI folks out, that's going to lower as well. And then you have an additional problem of foster kids. I mean, you take them into care, they need medical attention. We don't have birth certificates. We don't even sometimes know the real names of the parents. And so we have some of those issues we still have to contend with. So I'll let Clyde continue.
Representative Hansen.
If I could give you one heads up of a problem that dealt with about a year ago. My stepdaughter is adopted Korean, and she was adopted when she was 5 years old. We went through about 3 months of unmitigated hell in trying to prove her citizenship in California to get a driver's license. And the problem was her citizenship, her birth certificate, everything is basically her adoption records.
Mm-hmm.
And those aren't nearly as readily available as a birth certificate. Coupled with the fact that somehow when California was making the lists of what verified citizenship, adoption records were left off. So mm-hmm. I mean, she has no birth certificate.
Right.
She has no citizenship. She was the day she was adopted, she became a citizen. And anyway, keep a heads up on that in terms of... international adoptions, it should be very easy to determine. But
Chair Dalto,
the processes just weren't in place.
Right. Representative Hansen, actually, the way that this works is there's different levels of proof that you can show, some being what the federal government would consider. For instance, if you have a passport, then that's good because you had to get your birth certificate to get the passport, and it has your picture. So you're good to go both on the ID side and the birth record side. As the levels go down, they accept them, but overall for a state, they don't want us to accept the lowest level of ID before we've, considered all the top levels. And one of those is actually, I think on the second level, is your adoption papers. But remember, all of this comes from the federal government, and so we do have questions. We have a lot of Native Americans here that they don't have birth certificates, and their tribes maybe hover the border of Canada, United States, and if they were born on the Canadian side, they're not considered citizens here. There's a lot of issues that have not been explained to us that we're going to have questions on as time goes on.
And
so,
Chair Dolfo, Representative Hansen, we are still in the comment period on the new rule, so we'll take your comment and any others what you're hearing from constituents.
And one of the problems in that case with the verification of citizenship for the driver's license, there was a federal court docket number that was for the adoption, but to get that, the license came through after about 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
We never heard from the federal court in terms of finding the case based on just the case number. So if you've got an agency that's not really geared to do that type of rapid verification, vital records can do a turnaround in just a matter of hours. But some agencies, if you're depending on somebody else to have to verify it, if they're not set up to it, I mean, you could be looking at six months or a year before you could get verification if you don't accept the docket number or something.
Is that the comment period, is that for DHS or is that for the federal rule?
It's Chair Dolfo, it's for the federal rule, and it's so all states and will weigh in.
When does it end?
Representative Dolfo, it just started on the 12th, I believe, when the rules came out. The 12th starts the 12th, so we have a comment period. So remember, we have to implement this before the rules are final. And again, a big population was just taken out Friday. That's a big relief to us,
right.
But this is going to be ever changing, and we have to implement all of this, train our field people, tell the clients out there and the general public, this is what you're going to need if you come in. So, but then it's going to change. So it's an issue. It can be done, and we're going to do it. And we're going to comply with the rules.
So I think the way to do this is to have some kind of document that has like a matrix of, who the sort of affected classes are, who
sure.
the folks are that are being pulled off, like sounds like a certain senior population,
mm-hmm.
and so forth, and where maybe the problem areas are, and also that we're in this comment period so that, and to the legislature, so that if there are colleagues that have, input, like Representative Hansen did about adoptions and so forth, they know that, they can work with the department in this comment period.
Yeah, Chair Dolfo, we can go ahead and work something up and mill something out to members with kind of a matrix and some basic information.
I think
and
that'd be the way to go.
I know
there are a lot of questions about this, and people are receiving questions, so.
Sure.
That'd probably be the way to go.
Yeah.
Other
and
questions?
Chair Dolfo will also make sure that we include contact information so that as questions come up, you have a point of contact within
sure.
the department.
Sure. Questions or comments? Okay. You have a few comments to wrap up? Or?
No. Yeah, I guess the only thing I would leave people with is that while we do want to implement, we also want to be careful and not endanger clients who at some point in time we would be able to deem eligible. There is a kind of a reasonable effort period that the feds are allowing for that if they meet all other Medicaid requirements, they have 45 to 60 days depending on the program to then provide the citizenship verification. So we'll be working with our staff to make sure that they're helping clients to the extent that we are able to help them provide that verification.
Are you getting assistance sort of from private or nonprofit, the nonprofit sector, to help match people, you know, that may not have the resources to go after those birth records and so forth to prove their.
Chair Delta, we haven't at this point in time, but I think that would be a good avenue for us to explore and try to work with some people to help.
Representative Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Psyche, the last time that this committee was together, I think in January or thereabout, in the context of the discussion about ineligible recipients and perhaps illegal status or lack of legal status, the percentage, I think, that was given to us was that might have been perhaps less than 0.5%. So that would be about 2,500 people, assuming that would be an accurate representation. Now, is that number considered in, I guess, not 70,000, but the 10,000 number?
Chair Delco, Representative Flores, I believe it is. And it's just a total number of people who, you know, let me take that back. I'd have to check to see if we included that 2,500 number in the calculation, because it may be that we backed that out because we knew there may be a certain percentage that weren't going to be able to verify citizenship because they weren't. So let me get back to you on that, and I'll see if we backed that number out before we did the initial calculation.
And again, I think we would give an indication that there's no actual way to, at that point, verify the legality of citizenship for that particular cluster of individuals. And are you saying now that you do, so that you can have a better handle on what the number might be, even if the 2,500 is speculative?
At that point in time, Chair Delco, Representative Flores, at that point in time, under Medicaid rules, people were able to kind of self-declare. They just said, I am a citizen. And, of course, if it was later found out that they weren't, there were penalties that they faced for falsifying information. And there was not really a requirement that we had to do an actual verification of citizenship through passports and birth records and all of that type of thing. And that's why this is such a change now. We're not going to be allowed to just accept the self-declaration. We actually are required now to take the next step where we haven't been in the past, to actually have them provide us with a birth record or a passport or some form of verification.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, big change. Other parts of your presentation, or is that pretty much it?
That's it, Chair Delco.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Psyche. Interesting presentation. Colleagues, I suppose we'll stand in recess until 1 o'clock after the lunch period. Each time we'll accept a presentation on mental health and addiction programs. So with that, we are in recess.